Welcome to the Center for Spiritual Living Santa Rosa, a spiritual community that promotes global transformation through personal transformation. At the center, we are motivated by a compelling vision of a healthy, loving world, which we call the Global Heart Vision. This vision inspires us to bring the gifts of compassion and loving kindness to the world through our ministries and teaching. What you are about to hear is a recording of a message delivered at the Center for Spiritual Living Santa Rosa. Feel welcomed. Feel at home.
It's great to be here. I love you guys. Love this place. You might wonder what that picture is. That picture is actually from the wedding day. It's a little over 3 years ago. And the man crying, that's Kevin's dad. We're all crying. So that day was one of the most meaningful experiences in my rabbinic life. No hyperbole. And that's saying a fair amount since I've been a rabbi for almost a quarter of a century. So I asked myself, what made their wedding so special? What made it so special? So first I have to say that it helps that this Center for Spiritual Living is a special place. Helps that you have great musicians, really talented Reverend Edward. It helps. You are a community seeking meaning and purpose, and you show up with a palpable sense of energy, and it's infectious when you come here. That day, the place was filled to capacity for the wedding. And we did it in a round, so we did it in the middle, and place was full. It was like a sporting event. I mean, the cheering, you know, I had to calm people down. It felt great. It also helps, in terms of why it was meaningful, that Edward and I have been friends and colleagues for many years. He is my teacher. He is my confidant. I call him in the middle of the night when I'm upset. I will not share the range of subjects that we discuss. And he also likes to call me Rabbi, which is beautiful to me. He will not let me call him Reverend. And then there's Kevin, a fine, big-hearted man all on his own, the partner that Edward never thought he'd find. Remember? Edward was going to be single forever. And so it wasn't. I hope I didn't offend. Those factors of connection and compatibility would have been enough to make for a wonderful day. But having been blessed with many such occasions over the years, I've pondered what was the secret sauce that made it so special. First, there is the personal vulnerability of Kevin and Edward. They are two gay men, and Edward is a religious leader. And even in a liberal Sonoma County, both those facts would have been enough to give another couple pause. Add to that the fact that Edward is fundamentally a shy person, right? Doesn't really want to be in the center of attention. You realize they could have declared their love and commitment to each other in a private ceremony or even skipped the wedding altogether. Yet, they chose to hang it all out here and have a public ceremony. Their personal vulnerability cracked our hearts open, connecting us to them and to each other. Their personal vulnerability was key to that meaningful day, but really even that is not so rare. After all, any couple that weds publicly is vulnerable. So what made the wedding so special? And this is what I think it is. Over and above everything else, as a same-sex couple, they are part of a vulnerable class of people. And over and above everything else, we felt and recognized that truth. We could recall how not too long ago their wedding would have been unthinkable. We remember and felt the pain of generations of couples who had to hide their love and commitment to each other for fear of every kind of abuse. Really. A few years earlier, I had married two women in their 80s. Who had lived together for over 40 years as roommates. and as close friends. Beautiful occasion in the synagogue sanctuary. But when it came time to kiss, it was too much for them after all those years in the closet. When Kevin and Edward got married, our hearts broke open not only for them, but for all who had come before them, and our joy was mingled with our tears. Remembering Edward and Kevin's wedding leads me to consider this morning's theme, protecting the vulnerable, a theme shared with centers around the country today. Judaism's concern for the vulnerable surfaces in the book of Exodus in the Hebrew Bible, part of the five books of Moses, or the Torah, what many of you know as the Old Testament. So you remember the story in Exodus, Moses and God versus Pharaoh, let my people go, the Israelites are slaves in Egypt, and Moses leads a revolution, which includes 10 plagues, and they flee. Pharaoh's army comes after them. The sea parts, they make it to the other side. You got the general story? Yeah. Okay. Exodus, movement of Jah people. Oh, yeah. Bob Marley was the third world prophet. So they make it to the other side. And on the way, they go to Mount Sinai, where they receive the Ten Commandments. And right after they receive the Ten Commandments, they receive additional legislation that's very important for making a just society. And this is, let's see if I did it right, the arrow, yes. First time ever. This is what it says, Exodus 22, verses 20 and 21. You should not wrong the stranger or oppress him, for you are strangers in the land of Egypt. It also says, you shall not abuse any widow or orphan, as well as not taking advantage of the poor. So, here, the most vulnerable, according to this, and actually many other passages in the Bible, are the stranger, the orphan, the widow, and the poor. That was 3,500 years ago. But as much as things change, they stay the same. And you'll see with just a little interpretation, these categories still apply today. Remember, take the Bible too seriously to take it literally. Important. So you need to interpret it. I mean, on its own, it can be toxic, it can be deadly, it can be abused. So whenever you use the book, you need to be able to interpret it. But it doesn't take much here to see that folks who are vulnerable in ancient Israel are still vulnerable today. The poor. Consider that 1 in 3 people in Sonoma County, actually 1 in 3 households in Sonoma County, lives with chronic food insecurity, which means that every day they miss a meal. 1 in 3. I'm guessing that someone here, some folks here, right now are going, yeah, I live in food insecurity. 1 in 3. Orphans and widows are also still a vulnerable group, but in ancient Israel, they were especially prone to mistreatment because of the nature of tribal patriarchal societies. Without the protection of the male hierarchy, you can more easily be taken advantage of without recourse. See, in a patriarchal society, you needed the man to protect you. And without it, you were in trouble. We still struggle with this as women and their allies protest sexual harassment and fight to maintain their rights over their own bodies. My God, what's happened to our country? Okay, still struggling with it. Of all the ancient vulnerable classes, though, the one scripture is the most concerned about is the stranger, the unfamiliar, the other deemed dangerous. So the stranger in ancient Israel, 3,500 years ago, okay, most easily translates to today's guest worker, resident alien, immigrant, or refugee. And like the orphan and widow, the stranger could not rely on the help of the patriarchy. They could also not seek shelter with their tribe or kin. Worse, much of the rule of law did not apply to them, making them especially subject to mistreatment and abuse. So think about undocumented workers here today. They do a lot of work to make this country go. And if their employer abuses them, their employer can say, you know, I'll just have you deported. Same kind of vulnerability. I just want you to see how it translates from then until now. Scripture is so concerned about the stranger that it mentions the plight of the stranger 36 times. It's a great number. 18 means chai in Hebrew, which is life. 2 times 18, 36, double chai. It says, for example, you shall not oppress a stranger, for you know the soul of the stranger. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt, just a little later in the Torah. Then in Leviticus 19, it says, the stranger who resides with you shall be to you as one of your citizens. You shall love him as yourself, for you are strangers in the land of Israel. And in Deuteronomy, it says, you too must befriend the stranger, for you are strangers in the land of Egypt. And you know what? I could read 20 more. I won't do that to you. But at my first attempt at a slide, I had a bunch more. And then Edward helped me. So Jewish tradition teaches me to protect and defend the rights of the stranger, which include the LGBTQ community. Think about it. Being gay often means being robbed of the basic protective structures of society, just like the stranger in ancient Israel, either because the laws don't exist or they're not enforced. Hey, we live in a bubble. You know, and for us, this is Gay Pride Month, and this is Gay Pride Weekend. It's great. It's a celebration. But it came out of protest, and it still needs to be protest. We thought we had arrived, and maybe here we have, but not really. And if you're a trans person, you really need help. Vulnerable classes of people, the stranger, can be applied to many groups. Certainly the queer community is one group. And there are others, documented and undocumented immigrants, refugees, for sure, dreamers, the mentally ill. You know, if you're mentally ill and poor, you're likely going to jail for no crime. That's our treatment for the mentally ill and poor. Homeless, also a vulnerable class. And of course, people of color. I'm going to stop here for a second because Sonoma County is kind of white and kind of out in touch with the African-American community, and that is a vulnerable community. I just read a book called Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson, must read, and he shows so clearly that you can go from slavery to Jim Crow to mass incarceration. It'll break your heart, but I want you to have a sense of who the vulnerable is today, how the stranger can go from what it was in ancient Israel to our world today. The Jewish community is especially sensitive to the plight of people on the move, immigrants and refugees. Having spent most of the last 2,000 years a persecuted stateless minority, my grandparents fled a Europe aflame with unbridled nationalism and anti-Semitism. There was nothing new about this. Poverty, insecurity, and persecution were almost the daily story of the Jews of Europe for centuries, with a few exceptions. Still, the upheaval of the 20th century was exceptionally brutal. My maternal grandfather's family was in the lumber business, and after their mill was torched, they decided it was time to head for America. They couldn't get out at once, so my maternal grandfather, who was the oldest at 12 and a half, was sent, right? And then he brought everyone else over. His story is too common. Hundreds of thousands, and later millions of Jews fled Europe, joining the mixed multitude of non-Jewish European immigrants. Russians, Poles, Italians, Germans, the Irish, and others, all making their way to America. The numbers are staggering. Between 1880 and 1920, over 3 million Jews, 3 million, made their way from all over Europe to the teeming shores of the free world. And of course, they were the lucky ones, right? Because those that stayed behind were murdered by the Nazis a few years later. In America, my ancestors merged with millions of other people, other strangers with equally compelling stories. They brought with them little but their yearning for safety, prosperity, and peace. Though they carried few bags, their shoulders were bent with the weight of centuries of tsuras, trouble, persecution, insult, rape, murder, and fear. I imagine them on the boat coming to Ellis Island. The first sighting of land, the rising flame of the Statue of Liberty. "Keep ancient lands your storied pomp," wrote the Jewish poet Emma Lazarus. It's inscribed on the Statue of Liberty. "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." Well, the golden door is now seemingly barred shut, soon to be replaced by a wall. The current administration's war on immigration, the separation of children from parents, and their incarceration. Did you know that thousands of kids are still separated from their parents, and many will never find their parents again? The obstruction and denial of asylum seekers, the hateful rhetoric coming out of the White House, has re-triggered Jewish communal trauma, as has also sorely challenged our belief in what makes America great. We are, after all, a nation of immigrants. We should not be sending troops to the border. We should be sending food. We should be sending shelter. We should be sending clothing. And to be clear, I'm not saying we shouldn't have a border security. I'm just saying how we respond should be from a place of compassion for those most vulnerable people. It's clear that people on the move are vulnerable. Equally clear is the moral mandate to come to their aid. "You shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt." And really, when you think about it, it's overwhelming. All the vulnerable people in our society in need, that we're concerned about, need protection, care, love. And I've used only a few to illustrate the many with the hope that you will apply the idea of the stranger, the vulnerable, to your own heart and into your own lives. Now that we have a definition of the vulnerable, I want to move to the question, how are we to respond as people of faith, as spiritual communities? So I know that many spiritual centers are anxious not to mix spiritual practice with social justice work. And I understand why. It can be divisive and polarizing. I get it. But I ask you, what is the value of a spiritual practice that does not lead to a kinder, more just, and compassionate world? So the first step is to take a step, to realize that spiritual practice includes, I would suggest, demands social action. That is certainly the view of the Hebrew prophets who disdained religion devoid of morality. So we read this on the day of Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year, and our spiritual practice, one of them is to fast. And here, the prophet Isaiah is going to riff on that. You'll see. Beautiful. "Cry with a full throat, without restraint. Raise your voice like a ram's horn," says the prophet Isaiah, speaking for God. "Declare to my people their transgression, to the house of Jacob their sin. To be sure, they seek me daily, eager to learn my ways. Like a nation that does what is right, that has not abandoned the laws of its God, they ask me for the right way. They are eager for the nearness of God. Why then, we fasted, did you not see? When we starved our bodies, did you pay no heed? Because on your fast day, you see to your business and oppress all your laborers. Because you fast in strife and contention, and you strike with a wicked fist." Your fasting today is not... Sorry. Hold on. Your fasting today is not such as to make your voice heard on high. No, this is the fast I desire, to unlock fetters of wickedness and untie the cord of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, to break off every yoke. It is to share your bread with the hungry and to take the wretched poor into your home. When you see the naked, to clothe them and not to ignore your own kin. Then shall your light burst forth through the dawn and your healing spring up quickly. Your vindicator shall march before you. The presence of Adonai shall be your rear guard. Then when you call, God will answer. When you cry, saying, "Here I am." So the question, I think, is not whether to act, but how to act. It's not what I should do, but from where will I draw my strength? From where will my intention, my spirit, be directed? Dr. Martin Luther King argued that darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. But I must say that anger is very tempting. Right? I mean, every morning I get up and I get to the kitchen and Laura, my spouse, is up before me. She's already read the paper to the Press Democrat, New York Times. And then I get there and I sit down and I start to read and I start to feel ill. I actually go to the sports section. If the Warriors are winning, I'm happy. But we could be propelled by our anger at the injustice we see. And anger is a great motivator, but also toxic. I think of our current president and how much stomach lining I've lost, troubled over his actions and his words. And I ask myself, seriously, who does the bile in my belly benefit? It certainly does not in any way touch him, and it doesn't help me. Anger may be an appropriate motivator for some, but as Dr. King knew so well, love is a superior source. I am convinced, he preached, that love is the most durable power in the world. It is not an expression of impractical idealism, but of practical realism. Far from being the pious injunction of a utopian dreamer, love is an absolute necessity for the survival of our civilization. To return hate for hate does nothing but intensify the existence of evil in the universe. Someone must have sense enough and religion enough to cut off the chain of hate and evil, and this can only be done through love. When we see another person in need, our natural response, if our hearts are open, is to help. Keeping an open heart is the challenge, the core work of any spiritual practice. This is where the work of the center can be so helpful. It also brings us back to Kevin and Edward's wedding and the power of being personally vulnerable. Personal vulnerability is the key to most everything we want in life, to connection, to meaning, to love, to social justice. Vulnerability is about courage. It's about authenticity. It's about faith. Being vulnerable is being real, showing up, and not letting your fear rule over you. When we are vulnerable, our hearts are open, and the pain of the other, the stranger, the vulnerable, it touches us through love, out of love, for the sake of love, to act. Let's just do this for a second. Go like this, okay? And just feel what this feels like in your body. And now go like this. Feel the difference. Closed, angry. I struggle. I have an anger problem, okay? And then open. To be clear, I'm not talking about romantic love, but rather a love grounded in mutual responsibility and respect. Love as command, as moral obligation, a muscle-bound love. This is the primary meaning, by the way, of ahava, of love, in the Bible. Like the commandments to love your neighbor as yourself and love the stranger. According to my tradition, loving your neighbor or stranger means minimally caring for their basic needs like food, shelter, clothing, and more broadly, their dignity. We've come a long way this morning from Kevin and Edward's wedding to a biblically based definition of the vulnerable, and then a spiritually grounded, I hope, form of social advocacy. There's one last teaching I want to share that I think sums up why we're put on this planet, the work we're here to do, to be the hands and feet of God. Because that's what we are, right? God does not feed the hungry except through us. God does not clothe the naked except through us. God does not protect the stranger except through us. So this teaching comes from my current favorite Jewish thinker, a man named Emmanuel Levinas. He survived the Holocaust and then pursued his academic career in France. And he became a renowned philosopher in the secular and the religious world. His philosophy, his essential teaching, can be summed up in what he calls the revelation of the face. The revelation of the face. Everything you need to know about God, he teaches, can be seen in the face of another human being. In fact, he defines God as one's response to the other, the vulnerable, the stranger, which is infinite. Thank you.
You see why I call him my rabbi. And Rabbi George requested a song for us to sing from his community and Chris and the band, and I've learned it. It's about building this world with love, and you'll see it's very easy. It's almost like call and response, but you'll pick it up very quickly. And that will be our offering prayer. We'll sing it together. So to set that in motion, I invite you to get your gift in your hand. Ushers, please stand. And if you gave electronically, won't you place your hand on your chest as a symbol of your heart connection to your center and your contribution, and say after me, I bless this gift. I send it forth to heal and prosper. It does amazing work in the world. And so it is. Ushers, please receive the gift.